ServiceNow unterstützt ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
All engine running. Absolute genius.
Get this.
Welcome.
This is the show where we bring you
science.
What that essentially means is
discovery is
advances.
Questions.
Research.
Technology.
Unbelievable.
Without further ado,
this is The Naked Scientists.
Hello, welcome to The Naked Scientists. This is the show where we bring you the biggest breakthroughs in science, technology and medicine with me, Chris Smith. And today, Titans of Science is back, kicking off with Jocelyn Bell Burnell. She's the astrophysicist who discovered radio pulsars in her early career at Cambridge.
From Cambridge University's Institute of Continuing Education, this is The Naked Scientists.
Jocelyn Bell Burnell, or Dame Jocelyn Bell Burnell, more accurately, isn't it, was born on the 15th of July 1943 in Lurgan, County Armagh. She attended Lurgan College and then Mount School, which was a Quaker girls' boarding school in York, and then went to read natural sciences at the University of Glasgow. Jocelyn began her postgraduate studies in Cambridge in the late 1960s, where at the age of just 24, she discovered the phenomenon of pulsars. These are celestial entities that emit bursts of radio waves and other forms of electromagnetic radiation. And those findings led to a Nobel Prize, although not for her, and also inspired a famous Joy Division album cover, one of the best known record covers apart from Pink Floyd, possibly, with Dark Side of the Moon ever. And since then, Jocelyn served as president of the Royal Astronomical Society, president of the Institute of Physics. She was the Chancellor of the University of Dundee. And in 2021, she was awarded the Royal Society's prestigious Copley Medal, which is given annually for sustained outstanding achievements in any field of science. And I'm very delighted to say she is with me today in Cambridge. Hello, Jocelyn.
Hello. Good to be with you.
You're back here in Cambridge. This is where it really sort of started in a big way for you, isn't it? What was it like doing radio astronomy?
Very masculine, shall we say. And considerable anxiety amongst the female dons, the female academics, that if we, the female students, didn't behave, there's a risk that the men would say, huh, trust a woman, no more women in Cambridge.
What about the science, though? What was the situation with the topic you had chosen to study, and why did you go into it?
I became interested in astronomy as a teenager. I was good at science at school, especially physics. There was a glitch when it suddenly dawned on me, you do astronomy at night, and I like my bed, I like my sleep. And then I got to hear of astronomy at other wavelengths where the sun doesn't interfere in the same way, and in particular radio astronomy, which you can do day and night. So from my mid-teens, I was saying, I want to be a radio astronomer.
Just tell us about that, because it's not obvious to many people that you can do astronomy with forms of light that are not the forms we can see, that normally you would observe as a colour. So tell us how that works.
Our eyes are actually extremely limited. We see a very narrow range of wavelengths or frequencies. There's things like ultraviolet and infrared that we don't see. And if you go even further away from the bits we see, you find radio astronomy out the red end of the spectrum. And if you go out the blue end, violet end of the spectrum, you come to ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma ray. So there are many other kinds of radiations like light. Indeed, strictly speaking, light is a minority of all the possible radiations. But because it's what we're attuned to work with, we think it's the big thing.
What does it unlock, looking with those other wavelengths or colours of light we can't see, that we can't see with visible light?
Well, visible light can be blocked quite easily. Dust, for instance, will cut out visible light. You may have seen on foggy days how limited the sunlight is. So if we're able to study the universe in all these other wavelengths, then if that about 10% that is light is blocked for some reason, we've still got some chance of studying those objects.
And how advanced was that field in the 1960s when you came here to do your studies, your postgraduate studies, your PhD? How far ahead were we? What was our kind of understanding of what the universe looked like in those realms at that time?
Radio astronomy had started post-World War II. Indeed, there is a story that the Japanese were puzzled during the war, were puzzled by something that was blocking the radar. It was low in the east in the morning, high in the south in the middle of the day, and low in the west in the evening. It was actually the sun. The sun, when it's got lots of sunspots, can give out radio waves, which could block the Japanese radar. But post-World War II, radio astronomy really took off, studying the radio waves, not just from the sun, but from lots of other stars and galaxies and quasars and molecules in space and all sorts of things it's developed into.
You joined the laboratory of Anthony Hewish. He was your supervisor, wasn't he? So what problem was he trying to solve, and what challenge did he set you for your PhD?
There had been a grad student called Margaret Clark who had left just weeks before I arrived. Her particular project had been surveying the radio sky, looking at what objects were giving out radio waves. And she noticed that some of the objects that gave out radio waves, the signal wasn't steady. It fluctuated, it changed brightness. She noted that these were the objects that they thought were extremely compact objects. My thesis advisor, Tony Hewish, took over this idea and thought, maybe if we look for fluctuating radio sources, they'll turn out to be the very compact ones, which at that stage were suspected all to be quasars. There weren't many known at that stage. It was a really hot topic. So finding more quasars was my particular project.
And what is a quasar?
We didn't know what it was at that stage. We now know it's got a massive black hole in its middle, maybe several hundred million times the mass of the sun, and some rather more normal material around the black hole, probably in the process of falling into the black hole. The net result is these objects are very strong radio sources, often quite bright in the optical as well, but they're known as quasars, which is an abbreviation for quasi-stellar radio source, hence quasar. There was still considerable uncertainty about what quasars actually were. We now know that they're the same kind of mass as a galaxy, 100,000 million stars, much more compact and with a massive black hole at their centres, which drives lots of things.
How were you trying to find them?
It's a rather peculiar radio technique. Because they are extremely compact and because we're viewing them through the gubbins that there is in space between the sun and the planets, it's called the solar wind. The solar wind means that the signal from these compact objects will fluctuate, twinkle. So basically I'm looking for twinkling radio sources, which probably are quasars.
And how do you actually find them? What's the antenna you have to erect in order to detect these signals?
You do it at quite low radio frequencies. The wavelength was about 12 foot, you know, which is quite a big wavelength. You're looking for a twinkling, so you can't take long exposures, which means you need a very, very big telescope to pick up lots of signal because you can't average to improve the signal to noise.
Right, okay. And what's making that radiation? Where are those signals coming from?
We now know that quasars have massive black holes in their centres, and it's stuff around the black hole that generate the primary radio signal. Then as it travels through the space between the sun and the planets to reach us, the solar wind, the gas blowing out from the sun, affects it, alters its strength, so it fluctuates. So I'm looking for a randomly fluctuating radio signal, which means there's a very compact object out there and it must be pretty strong if I can see it.
You therefore start to get this data, having got the detection system working. When did it become apparent to you that there might be something interesting to see?
I actually spent the first 2 years sledgehammering. I built the equipment along with about half a dozen other people, and it took us 2 years.
With a sledgehammer?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I literally did a lot of sledgehammering. I could swing a sledgehammer. I was playing field hockey at the time, and I could hit the hockey ball from one end of the pitch to the other, which my teammates never learnt to, you know, start running.
Did suddenly everyone on the hockey team want to be a radio astronomer? Because clearly this is the path to greatness on the hockey pitch.
It was useful on the hockey pitch, particularly if you're playing full back, because, you know, it shifts the ball to the far end of the pitch and you and the other full back can stop and have a chat and watch the others doing things at the far end of the pitch.
But what were you actually sledgehammering?
We were building a radio telescope, and it had to be a very large area radio telescope because we couldn't do these long exposures. So if you're operating with short exposures, you need large area.
Were you thinking then, flipping heck, I've done 2 years of this, a PhD's only 3 years long. Were you getting a bit nervous then, thinking at what point am I actually going to get some data to work with?
I think I'd been told it would probably take 2 years, but I did feel it was rather a lot of manual labour for an academic qualification.
Because the thing is, you can't publish as a thesis building a radio telescope because that's not advancing knowledge. So you must have been a bit nervous thinking, well, when am I going to get something I can actually publish?
I don't remember being nervous about that. What was really good was the first time we switched it on, it worked. And it's probably the first radio telescope in history to work the first time you switch it on. Normally you switch it on and something's not working, so there's nothing coming in.
What was the readout? What was the display then? How were you showing yourself what it was seeing, this telescope?
We had pen chart recorders, you know, rolls of paper that rolled under a pen. And the pen did this continuous squiggle along this rolling sheet of paper. And I ended up with several miles of paper after 6 months of observing.
And is that one of those pictures that Joy Division used as their album cover? Is that one of those charts?
It's snippets from several charts taken and lined up.
And so when did you then, you say it worked straight away. Well, how did you know it was working? But when did you then say, look, there are some interesting signals in here. I am seeing these twinkling phenomena I was going after.
The purpose of the exercise was to find more of these quasi-stellar radio sources. And they became very clear as soon as I got the thing on and running. So that was my main thesis job. And in fact, we couldn't, Tony said, change the title of the thesis. So the majority of the thesis was on these quasars and how they twinkled. The twinkling is actually caused by plasma blowing out from the sun, solar wind, it's called. And it's not smooth. It's a wind with clouds in it. And the clouds disrupt the radio signal from the distant quasar and make the quasar appear to change brightness. It's actually not itself changing in brightness. It's because of the mess made by this solar wind that you pick up a fluctuating signal. Whereas other kinds of radio objects in the sky are much more extended, and you see them through several different bits of the solar wind at the same time, and so the solar wind effect averages out. So it's a neat technique for picking up compact objects like quasars.
It's a bit like when you've got the fog lights on the car, the red, you can see through the fog. It doesn't scatter much, but the white light gets scattered all over the place. So he's an Irishman. Tyndall, John Tyndall discovered the Tyndall effect. Yes. That's exactly that, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, John Tyndall was Irish, yes. In the days when we didn't distinguish between North and South Ireland.
But the thing that you're best known for is what you labelled on one of those charts you had miles of, that you wrote LGM, Little Green Men, as a joke. I mean, it was a joke, wasn't it? But what was that, and why did that stand out to you, that signal?
Once you've used the radio telescope for several weeks and seen all the kinds of phenomena it picks up, you get to say, yep, that's a quasar. That's radio interference. That's somebody with a badly suppressed car or a pirate radio station or something like that. There was on occasion another signal that didn't fit in either of those categories. It just looked different. You can explain it in terms of Fourier analysis, but we won't go there, I think, in this. It looked different. And the first few times I logged it with a question mark and carried on because I've got miles of this paper to plough through. And by the third or fourth time I saw it, my brain said, you've seen something like this before, haven't you? You've seen something like this before from this bit of sky, haven't you? And then it's easy because I'm storing the rolls of paper according to which latitude on the sky I'm observing in shoeboxes. So I find the shoebox that covers that latitude strip. Now, this is the one I've just seen. Wasn't there last time we looked at that bit of sky, but the two, maybe three times before it was there, and it's from the same bit of sky. What's going on? You probably know you see different constellations in the summer and the winter sky, but this phenomenon wasn't changing with the date. It was keeping its place amongst the constellations, apparently. And I showed this to my thesis advisor and he was quite convinced I'd done something wrong. So there was a famous occasion where he came out to the observatory at the time this thing was due to be passing overhead and watched me set up for the observations and saw the pulses coming in himself. And he began to take it more seriously then.
What did they look like? What were those pulses? And why were they leaping out at you saying, this is not car interference, there's something a bit different here?
The thing was going blip, 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 blip. Now, quasars do a certain amount of blipping, but they go blippity blip, 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 blippity blip, 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 blip.
That's the twinkling, isn't it? That's the variation you mentioned.
That's right. Whereas this thing had a steady beat. And it really looked man-made. It looked artificial. And we put a lot of effort into trying to explain it as something artificial. But it moved round the sky with the stars. And this thing, whatever it was keeping its place amongst the stars and getting 4 minutes earlier each day.
Did you think for a second, do you think I found aliens?
It was unlikely to be aliens. And that idea disappeared as soon as I found a second and then a third and a fourth, all in different parts of the sky.
Ah, so that would argue that whatever it was that was doing it where you first saw it, that phenomenon was obviously being repeated across the sky in other patches of the universe.
Yes.
And it was then a question of, so what's causing it?
Yeah. And the interesting thing was the subsequent ones that I found were similar, but beat, pulsed at a different rate. Each one had its own rate. One of them had a pulse rate of a quarter second. It was really zinging along. It was quite hard to catch it. It was going so fast. The other three were all 1-point-something seconds, period. So it was going blip, blip, blip at a reasonable rate.
You knew then, once you started seeing these things coming from elsewhere in the sky and also tracking with the stars in the way you knew you had to be onto something. So how did you pursue that then? Because you're in your PhD. There's only a limited amount of time and resource in a PhD. So what did you decide to do?
Well, most of the effort went into establishing that this was real because they were so extraordinary. We couldn't publish and then discover, oh, we forgot to check such and such, and that's what's causing it. So we had to make sure we didn't fall into that trap. So the first job was to ask a colleague and his graduate student. They also had a separate radio telescope, separate receiver, on the same site but separate kit, to ask them very quietly, could you take a look at this particular spot of the sky, please, and tell us what you see? And I vividly remember that particular test. We were working with a grad student called Robin Collins. My telescope saw the thing shortly before Robin's telescope was due to see it, and mine showed it was pulsing nicely. And then we went and stood by Robin's chart recorder and nothing happened.
So then what?
Well, the two academics started walking down this very long laboratory discussing, now what could it be that shows in our radio telescope, not yours? Could it be, no, it can't be that because you're right. What about, no, can't be that. And it's quite a long laboratory. And I was padding along behind them. Robin stayed by his pen recorder. And we've got down the end of this long laboratory and suddenly there's a shriek from Robin. Here it is! And we went charging back up. Robin had miscalculated by 5 minutes when his telescope would see it. I mean, thank goodness it wasn't 25 minutes or we'd all have gone home. But that was fantastic. It's not some fiction of my equipment. It's being seen by a separate radio telescope with a separate amplifier and a separate pen recorder. A totally separate system. It's something way beyond the observatory, whatever it is.
What did we have in our kind of repertoire of understanding of physics and astrophysics at that time that could account for that? Or was it a complete blank sheet?
It had to be something physically very small because it's pulsing quite fast, responding quite fast. But it's also quite strong, whatever it is. It's got a sizable radio signal. So it's small and it's big. Doesn't quite make sense. We were really very puzzled as to what it was.
If you've got something small, but it's powerful, that sort of star regime, would that put it into the neutron star kind of regime then? Because you're talking about something incredibly dense, incredibly massive, lots of material in there, but very compact.
Yes, although we didn't see at that stage how a neutron star could produce blasts of radio waves or beams of radio waves. It has to be a highly magnetized neutron star, spinning quite fast, with its magnetic axis offset from the spin axis. So you get a beam coming out of the magnetic poles, which then swings around as the star spins.
Well, what's wrong with that? Why can't that be the case?
Well, nobody'd ever seen anything like that before. Well,
they'd never seen LGM either.
Well, some people probably thought they had seen LGM, but never mind that.
I know what you mean, but no one had seen what you saw. No. And so what was wrong with saying, well, this is what we think it is then?
I guess we were still trying to make sure we believed this. An important stage was when I found a second, and then a third, and a fourth. And the fourth one pulsed much faster. But astronomical objects are big things. How can they go bung, 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 bung at that rate? It doesn't make sense. But we had to publish. You couldn't sit on the result any longer.
What was the reaction like? So you put this out there and you say, we've got this, we've found more examples of it. Did you speculate in that paper as to what it might be, or did you just leave it as a blank canvas?
I can't honestly remember without going back. We published the first one first and said we've got some more, so this is not alone. And then the other three followed in another paper a few weeks later. People were quite cross that we wouldn't give them the details of numbers 2, 3 and 4 right away because they wanted to follow up the observations. But the reaction to the first paper was phenomenal. There are umpteen stories of senior radio astronomers saying to somebody, I know you're scheduled on the telescope tonight, you're not. We're having the telescope to go and observe this fantastic new thing. So a lot of people were jumping on the bandwagon very quickly, very interested.
What did it unlock? And how were you able to then pursue that observation to then solve the problem?
I had another three of these that I had discovered. I found the first four, and we published numbers 2, 3 and 4 in a subsequent paper. And the fourth one was a good deal faster. So that's obviously going to constrain what kind of object it was. There were various ideas floating around about what they might be. My supervisor, Tony Hewish, had one. When he gave the colloquium announcing the discovery in Cambridge, Fred Hoyle was in the audience. Tony thought it was a type of star called a white dwarf, which was probably oscillating, breathing in and out and launching shock waves into the atmosphere with each breath. When he'd finished his colloquium, Fred Hoyle was the first person to speak. And in his best Yorkshire accent, I don't think it's an oscillating white dwarf. I think it's a neutron star. Neutron stars being a good deal smaller. And at that stage, talked about by some mad theoreticians, but nobody really believed in them.
No one believed neutron stars were real at that time.
They were really rather extreme, but this was the proof that they existed.
Well, that argues, well, they exist, but how did you explain the phenomenon that put you onto them in the first place, which was this pulsation? How did you then reconcile the fact we've got this giant ball of neutrons, very compact, very small, very energetic, but it's pulsing? How did that hang together?
The pulsing is an observational effect. It's a bit like a lighthouse. The lighthouse beam is steady, but it swings around the sky and you only see it when it's shining in your face. So you see pulse, 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 pulse. And it's the same with these neutron stars, or pulsars as they're now called. There's beams coming out of the north and south poles. And as this swings around, the beam may shine on your radio telescope, or it may miss Earth totally. But if it shines on your radio telescope, you see pulse, 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 pulse each revolution.
You were lucky it shone on your telescope. What was the reason that the pulse swings round, though? Is that magnetic?
The pulse is shaped by the star's magnetic field, and the star is spinning. So you can think of a beam coming out of the north and south magnetic poles of this star, a bit like a lighthouse beam. And if the magnetic axis is offset from the spin axis, like it is on Earth, magnetic north is not at true north. Similarly for these stars, the beam is coming out of magnetic north, the star is spinning around true north, and so the beam cones around the sky. And if Earth happens to lie on that cone, you get a pulse.
My mind is boggling at the idea of one of these things spinning around four times a second, which is what you spotted in one of the examples, isn't it? How does it do that?
Yeah, actually, they go much faster than that. That's by no means the fastest. You can certainly get 30 times a second. They are very compact stars. They're only about 10 miles across, but they weigh the same as the Sun, more than the Sun.
Do any of them have planets?
We suspect that at least one does, yes. Planets marginally upset the spin of the star. And so we got such fantastic accuracy with these pulsars that we can see slight wobbles in the rotation rate, which are probably due to planets. I don't think we could ever prove that, but that seems the most likely explanation for a bit of a wobble in the pulse period.
How on earth did you go forward from this? Because there's sort of one way to start a career is to build up gently. Another is to put a huge rocket under it and explode from the beginning. Was it not difficult then, having done this and seen this dramatic beginning to your career, to then carry it on at that sort of pace?
It was made very difficult by my getting married. I got engaged to be married between discovering pulsars 2 and 3, I think it was. And we got married between my submitting my PhD thesis and having the viva. So the examiners didn't know what surname to use. And I married somebody who worked in local government. And the way we operated it was he'd have a job and I'd get a job at a nearby astronomy place. And then say after a bit, it's time I moved. And I could see my world falling apart. And he'd start looking at job adverts and he'd say, if I go to Timbuktu or somewhere, is there anything astronomical anywhere near that where you might get a job? And that's the way we operated it. He'd go for the job. If he got the job, I'd then write a begging letter to the nearest astronomy place. And so I left radio astronomy and went to work in gamma ray astronomy, which is the other end of the spectrum. Not many gamma rays around. And then we moved again and I migrated to X-ray astronomy. And then we moved again and I migrated to millimetre and infrared astronomy. Absolutely crazy career. I don't think it even deserves the word career.
And you've seen enormous changes over your career from where we had to build primitive Vineyard light telescopes to see things like this through to what the James Webb is now enabling us to do, to literally see through the atmospheres of planets that aren't even in the solar system. And it is extraordinary, isn't it, the way that this has advanced?
I think one of the most extraordinary things is us discovering many extrasolar planets, planets around other stars, stars that may be like the Sun or maybe not like the Sun, but there seem to be a lot of planets around there with all kinds of configurations, patterns for these planets around these other suns. It's a new area of astrophysics that's absolutely booming at the moment, and I suspect it's still raising more questions than answers. It's that young a subject.
Speaking of which, do you think that little green men do exist for real, given the statistics we now have and what you just said about the numbers of these exoplanets, planets that are outside our own solar system around other stars? Given the scale of the universe and the scale of those numbers, do you think it's an inevitability that there's a Jocelyn and a Chris somewhere else having a radio interview?
I don't know what life looks like. I don't know whether it's intelligent or less intelligent than us at this stage. But I would be surprised if we were the only life in the universe, that's for sure.
And what would you really love the answer to? With the time you have left in research and your life and your career and space science, what question leaps out at you thinking, if I could have the answer to that tomorrow, I'd be a happy woman?
There's a new branch of astronomy that I've been watching developing all my career. It's called gravitational wave astronomy. It's nothing to do with radio waves or light waves or infrared or ultraviolet or X-rays or any of those. It's to do with the way, for instance, Earth going round the Sun alters the gravitational field of the Sun. You can think of an object like the Earth as actually denting the gravitational field. And then as it moves around the Sun, it makes a kind of groove that fills up and opens up as the Earth goes round. And those kind of changes in a gravitational field can produce what we call gravitational radiation. And it was a field I was watching develop from quite early days. The signals are very weak. It's very, very hard to do, but we are now doing it. And it's fantastic to have a whole new spectrum delivering information for us. So I'm watching things coming in from that with real interest, because that's the latest window opening.
A wonderfully told story from a wonderful scientist. Thanks very much to Jocelyn Bell-Bunnell. Next time, our new season of Titans of Science continues when we speak to the man who utilised AI, artificial intelligence, to crack the structures of proteins, picking up a Nobel Prize along the way. He is biochemist David Baker. The Naked Scientist comes to you from the University of Cambridge's Institute of Continuing Education. It is supported by Rolls-Royce. I'm Chris Smith, and from all of us here at the Naked Scientist team, thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
Mit Asana ist KI nicht mehr nur ein Tool, sondern ein Teammitglied. Jetzt hilft Asana AI Ihnen, Ihre Ziele besser zu erreichen und verknüpft Sie mit relevanten Projekten, damit alles planmäßig verläuft. So arbeiten Ihre Teams intelligenter und schneller. Asana, die führende Plattform für KI-gestütztes Workmanagement. Jetzt kostenlos testen auf asana.com. asana.com.